I complained the other night about the way we're distracted from Iraq. We're talking about the body count, very understandably, in Egypt and in Syria, but not in Iraq. But that figure is incredibly significant. And joining me to unravel the reasons for this upsurge in killings, and yes, its connection with broad regional unrest, two Middle East experts, Patrick Coburn, Rosemary Hollis. Patrick is, of course, the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, and Rosemary is Professor of Middle East Policy Studies at City University, London. Welcome, both of you, to our little wireless program. Patrick, the violence over the last month has been at a level that we haven't seen in quite a while. Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq has claimed responsibility. Would you be kind enough to explain in words of one syllable what you think is going on?
Well, we had a bad situation, which is getting worse. Al-Qaeda is stronger because of events in Syria. It now is making attacks on both sides of the border. The government, which is basically Shia Muslim in Baghdad, has alienated the Sunni, who are really the supporters of Al-Qaeda, 20% of the Iraqi population. And that gives more of a base for Al-Qaeda, brings them more support. So we've had more and more suicide bombings. We've had more and more car bombs. We've had levels of civilians being killed. Getting back to the levels of 2008, which was really the almost the level of the civil war we had just prior to that. So overall, we have Iraq fragmented, still holding together, Al-Qaeda getting stronger, making more attacks, and the government not being able to do much about it.
You've made the point that the Sunni minority in Iraq feel that the regional balance is swinging a bit in their favour, and they started to demonstrate in December. You say modelling their protest on the Arab Spring, wanting reform rather than revolution.
That's correct, yes. But they didn't get enough reforms to satisfy them, and the government thinks that they basically don't want reform. They want a return to the old Iraq under Saddam Hussein, when the Sunni were the dominant sect in Iraq. So the government is unsympathetic, has basically been pretty crude in the way it's treated them. There were a mass killing earlier in the year at Hawija. And certainly it's alienated a lot of the Sunni, and more support has flown to Al-Qaeda and to people making military attacks, or in fact they're mostly targeting civilians, people in markets, etc., wherever civilians, Shia civilians, gather.
Before I go to Rosemary Hollis, a couple of other questions for you, Patrick. What part is the war in Syria playing?
I think it's... Before the war in Syria, things were stabilizing to a degree, stabilizing within Iraq at quite a high level of violence. I mean, there were lots of attacks, but by Al-Qaeda-linked organizations. I think the uprising, really, of the Sunni majority in Syria emboldened the Sunni in Iraq. It destabilized the area. There's scarcely a frontier between Iraq and Syria these days, so Al-Qaeda can move backwards and forwards much more easily than before. And I think there's more Sunni militancy in the area, so it's easier for them to get weapons and support. So I think that that has changed, and the government really has dug in its heels and doesn't see reforms as the way forward. Certainly it hasn't made enough of them.
Patrick, I find it very hard to sing the praises of John McCain, but does he make sense when he laments the fact that the US didn't leave behind a residual force in Iraq to help deal with this kind of increased sectarian violence?
I'd say absolutely not, because I think it's really against reason, this, because, I mean, the last time we had a full-scale civil war between Shia and Sunni in Iraq, the Americans had 100,000, 150,000 troops in the country. So it's, you know, it's bizarre to suggest that the presence of some American troops would really make much difference. you know, I suppose you could argue that, you know, the Americans at moments could play the role of mediator and go from one community to the other, particularly at the end of their stay in Iraq. But the presence of American troops really, I don't think, would stop this. The tide of events is too strong for an American presence to have made a crucial difference.
Well, we've had a long American presence. It's 10 years since the US invasion, Patrick. It seems much, much longer somehow.
It does, because it sort of ended one era in the Middle East and began another. And, you know, it also is a measure of whatever people thought the invasion was going to achieve, whatever Iraqis hoped, and what they hoped was a better life. You know, that maybe it's true of some of them, but for an awful lot it's not true, and for quite a number it's not only not true because it's not true because they're dead. But, you know, there are still horrendous figures for the number of people killed, you know, up to 1,000 in some months, according to some authorities. But the rest of the world has almost sort of come to associate Iraq with mass killings, so, you know, it hardly gets a mention on page 8 in the newspapers.
The voice of Patrick Coburn is the Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper, and on this occasion he's talking to us out of Ireland. Let's now whiz over to the ABC's London studio and invite Professor Rosemary Hollis, Professor of Middle East Policy Studies at City University, to join the debate. Rosemary, how much blame for the security situation in Iraq should be placed with the Prime Minister for what some analysts call just plain bad governance?
Ooh. Do you know, I thought you were going to ask me about how much blame should be placed with the invasion.
Well, I'm only too happy to do so. Please, let me rephrase the question. How much blame because of the bloody invasion?
Well, I think it's important because, as Patrick just said, that was a watershed moment, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the end of one era and the beginning of another one. And it was the moment at which the United States willfully wasted its own power and influence, including military capability in the region, and is now no longer capable of that level of intervention anywhere else. It was, of course, simultaneous with conducting the war in Afghanistan, and that didn't go too well either. And the combination of the two mean that they simply can't do the same thing again in the region in the face of new contingencies. But also, Patrick mentioned this hope that things would get better for Iraqis as a result of the intervention, and that it only has for those who survived and not all of those. I think this notion that Western intervention, the British have this disease as well as the Americans, but the British have
and
had it
we
longer.
And we sign up for it too, Rosemary Hollis. Australia's got a bad habit of sticking its nose in.
Well, I would say actually that I was in Australia shortly after the invasion in 2003, and one or two military experts there were asking me, why didn't you British do what we Australians did, which was offer a couple of thousand or so special forces who were deployed out in the desert and help with targeting in the early days of the invasion, and then managed to go home to look after some other contingencies in the Pacific and were on the right side of things in Washington, but not bogged down in the war. And I thought it was quite a good question, actually. But at the time, the British had weren't going to take that route because they were so closely bound to the Americans in the sense that they thought anything was possible if they worked with the Americans in the region. And of course, Tony Blair was going to make the region better. So was George Bush at the time. And this I'm calling a disease simply because it's exactly the same language as the Victorians used to use in the 19th century about how they were going to civilize the natives of Africa or the Arab world or wherever.
Well, I'm glad you preempted my question by asking your own. But let me go back to the current Prime Minister now. Let's leap forward 10 years. To what extent has he made things significantly worse by being inept?
Well, I think the key thing here is that in addition to this lack of inclusivity in sectarian terms, that the government is essentially Shia and has failed to reach out to the Sunni minority in Iraq and to include them in meaningful ways in the administration, and is actually in pursuit of some of the key figures, Sunni, who were in the government. But in addition to that, there's the Persian Arab dimension to the current confrontation across the north of the Middle East. And Maliki is seen to be too close to Tehran, too ready to cooperate with the Iranians, too on side with their regional agenda, to be welcomed by other Arab forces. And as if this weren't bad enough, the Arab-Persian rivalry that goes on, manifested first and foremost by the rivalry between the Saudi regime on the Arab side and the Iranian Islamic Republic on the Persian side, and the sectarian dimension to confrontation, we've just seen played out, or playing out in the Egyptian context, the extraordinary visceral hatred that the Saudis have for the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a fellow Sunni dispensation. And so there is internal rivalry between Arabs over power within the Sunni community. And whilst the Saudis' actions in the region, including their massive funding of the new military administration in Cairo, can be attributed to their rivalry and dislike of the Muslim Brotherhood, you have the Qataris, traditional rivals of the Saudis in the Persian Gulf, supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. And both are involved in supporting different elements of the opposition to Assad in Syria.
Yeah.
So it's about as complicated as you might wish to get it.
Well, it's much less complicated as I listen to you and Patrick. LNL on RN, Rosemary Hollis from City University, and Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. Patrick, you have been covering Syria, I dimly recall, since the 1970s, and you've been going there regularly during the current conflict. What's it really about?
Well, it's, you know, just as Rosemary was saying about the region in general, it's a series of different struggles, confrontations going on, all laid on top of each other and complicating each other. Initially, you had a popular uprising against a dictatorship, against a very brutal and authoritarian dictatorship. But this was, from the beginning, had a sectarian element of Sunni Arabs, the Sunni majority, against Alawites and others who were in control. And it rapidly turned also into a part of the quarrel, the ferocious quarrel between Shia and Sunni in the Middle East, and between Saudi Arabia and its ally in the US and its allies, and Iran and its allies. So you have all these quarrels on top of each other, and they all make it so difficult to reach any solution for, and also solution by either side winning. You know, one thing that strikes one, me traveling around Syria, that both sides have areas they control very tightly, both sides have their support. Neither side is really strong enough to overcome the other. They may not quite realize themselves, but that's the truth. They also have allies who don't want to see the conflict end without achieving some sort of victory. Countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar don't quite know what they're going to do, but one thing they don't want to see is it the war end with Assad still in power and with Iran and the Shia having basically survived a Sunni onslaught. So that's what one of the many things that keeps the fighting going on.
Rosemary, you've argued that the story of Lebanon civil war that ended in 1990 and the outcome of that war now looks like a foretaste of the tragedy unfolding across the whole Middle East. Would you talk to that briefly?
Okay, it was, as a Jordanian academic I know defined it, he did his PhD on Lebanon, and he suggested one of the elements going on in Lebanon was when the central government, which is of a particular type in Lebanon, but nonetheless, take it as an analogy, when the central government is no longer able to deliver the values that citizens of a country look to a government for, that is basic protection and security, as well, or on top of which they also look to the government for health and economic well-being. If a government ceases to be able to provide that, then citizens will look elsewhere for their defence. And what started as a divide into, let's say, about three camps, rapidly deteriorates into several camps as sectarian groups or tribal groups or ethnic groups subdivide right down to the street and neighbourhood level, looking for the protector on the spot. And one way of describing this is a sort of form of warlordism, where there is no central government in the states. And eventually, there's various theories as to what it was that finally brought the Lebanon internal war to an end. But from the start, external players, both regional and international, were involved. The Americans at one stage declared Lebanon a vital national interest to the United States. And then when 240 or so US Marines were blown up in Beirut by suicide truck bombers, the Americans up sticks and went home, and it was no longer a vital interest to sort the place out. It fell to a consortium of Arabs in the end to work out a formula, but that was 15 years on from the start of the war, with failed interventions by others in between. And in this instance, it was order was restored in part because Syria was given the job or the privilege of maintaining order inside Lebanon. So I think what we're looking at across the region is the breakdown of effective central government in one capital after another, and the inability of external players to form a coherent agenda that they could all combine on. On the contrary, they're actually competing. We've got Russia and the Americans on different sides vis-a-vis what should happen in Syria, for example. And in those circumstances, it's easy for the borders between countries to erode.
Absolutely. Well, Patrick, you've actually described what's going on in Syria as a sort of Cold War reborn.
Yeah, that's the it's two kinds of Cold War, really. One, it's the old traditional Cold War with Russia, between the US and Russia. And one of the new elements in the situation, that Russia is sort of back as a great power, refusing to give ground in the Security Council, supporting Assad, in a way that they haven't been playing that sort of role for about 20 years since the breakup of the Soviet Union. So that's an important new element, and one that the sort of Americans are taking on board, that if they push hard in Syria, the Russians will push hard back. And then, of course, we have the other sort of hot-cold war between the US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, on the other hand. Iran leading this sort of alliance of Iran and Syria and Hezbollah and some others. So both those are back in business. I think that, you know, one point, just picking up on what Rosemary was saying, we've had a sort of failure of government, and we've also had a failure of opposition simultaneously. I mean, you talk to people in Damascus, and a lot of people say, well, government pretty bad here, but look at the alternative, you know. The alternative to the Assad government, with all its brutality, is anarchy, and violent anarchy, with people chopping off heads, with Christian priests being murdered, with local warlords with total banditry. And a lot of them who were neutral with misgivings now think, well, maybe we're better off with the present lot. Of course, an awful lot of people think, what I want is get a visa just as fast as I can to go somewhere else out of Syria. And, you know, maybe we're seeing the same thing in Cairo, a failure of government, a failure of the opposition, maybe now a failure of government again. But that seems to be the pattern across the region. You know, Saddam was replaced, and look what we got instead of Saddam. Doesn't mean Saddam was good, means both were pretty bad. And I think we're certainly seeing that in Syria.
As we wind this up, Rosemary, Russian and US officials are due to meet at The Hague next week to discuss preparations for a Geneva 2 conference on Syria. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think increasingly over time, especially given the new contingency in Egypt, you may see the Americans climbing down a bit and saying maybe less lives would have been lost and less blood spilt if we'd gritted our teeth and allowed for a crackdown by the Assad regime, because that, in effect, is what we're now going to allow or leave be in Egypt.
Patrick, you wrote a piece in the London Review that for the first time since Britain and France carved up the remains of the Ottoman Empire after the First World War, there's a feeling that the future of whole states in the Middle East is in doubt. And you think that feeling is growing apace across the region?
It is, and it, sometimes it's to a degree it's sort of outdistanced on the ground. Of course, you have sort of non-functional, poorly functioning governments with limited legitimacy, less power. You also just have frontiers disappearing. You know, where is the frontier between Iraq and Syria at the moment? You know, are they on the Syrian side? The border posts aren't manned. The border between Syria and Turkey, same thing, that you know, that rebels pass to and fro. So, you know, you have this general crisis which is spreading across the Middle East and cross-infecting different countries. And it's very difficult to see how this will end, because lots of different confrontations we had in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the US and Shia and Sunni, and democracy against dictatorship are sort of coming together like sort of different chemical ingredients and producing a truly explosive mixture.
Rosemary, do you share that very gloomy view of Patrick's?
I do, absolutely. I think but the state system was imposed by the British and French imperialists at the beginning of the 20th century, and it was the Americans and the Brits who invaded Iraq, and that broke the mold of what was essentially a dictatorial state system in the region. And I think there was a rush of blood to the head in the West with the Arab revolutions to conceive of a smooth transition from a bunch of dictatorships in states with borders that they didn't choose, that cut across all kinds of social and sectarian and ethnic links, that this could transit into something looking like the European Union in terms of these happy democracies living side by side and being prosperous. But I think instead it's more like Europe at the beginning of the 20th century, where they had to have two world wars to sort out exactly where the borders were.
I've got to thank you both for your scepticism and your lucidity. I think this has been a really interesting chat. Rosemary Hollis, good on you, Professor of Middle East Policy Studies at City University, and another old friend of the program in Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper. And this is a little wireless program called LNL on RN. Languages, there's so many languages in the world. You'll hear figures shortly, thousands and thousands of them, but they are evaporating, they are vanishing all over the place. Well, I've got a guest who thinks she's discovered a shiny, bright new one up north, and we'll cross to that story after a little bit of music.